What's next for Washington and the nation? From the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol to the election of two Democratic senators from Georgia, the resignation of cabinet members, and the certification of Joe Biden's election, this week will go down in U.S. history. And events are still unfolding. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is considering a rapid-fire impeachment of the president. Others are begging for the vice president to invoke the 25th Amendment. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll get analysis and perspective from people intimate with the law of the land and the political machinations currently underway. What are your questions about what comes next, what's possible, and what it means for the country? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This week in Washington was like any other in our nation's history. The failed insurrection on Wednesday, the certification of the Electoral College vote in the dead of night, dramatic results in the Georgia Senate races, the resignation of cabinet members. Today we're going to discuss what all of this means with Susan Page, who is USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief. She's the author of Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty, and is also the author of the forthcoming book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Ron Schmidt, also with us, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. His most recent book is Reading Politics with Machiavelli. We invite your questions and comments. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Susan and Ron, welcome both of you back to Maine Calling. And Susan Page, I'm going to start with you. What are you hearing from your sources? Will impeachment proceedings get underway? And if so, when will the vice president and cabinet members move to invoke the 25th Amendment?
Well, Jennifer, these are momentous times indeed. I've been in Washington since 1979 and through a lot of crises. This is like nothing I've seen before this week. Yes, I think it is likely, although not guaranteed, that the House will move to impeach the president. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has made it clear she's in favor of that. And it's something that can be done rather quickly because it involves drawing up some articles of impeachment and passing them. Democrats do control the House, although not by very much. That doesn't mean the issue will be taken up in the Senate, that the Senate will get itself together to have a trial. We know from the previous impeachment attempt with President Trump that that took some time. Republicans still in control of the Senate for the next little bit until they reconvene with the new members elected from Georgia this week. The question of the 25th Amendment is a more complicated one, I think, is much less likely to happen. Lots of calls for Vice President Pence to try to invoke the 25th Amendment, but that also requires a majority of the Trump cabinet to support that idea. We've seen the members of the Trump cabinet most likely to support that idea resigning, two of them resigning in the last 24 hours. I think that is an unlikely thing to happen. But the fact that there are so many calls for this, including by some Republicans, is a sign of the times that we're in.
And Ron, I wanted to ask you some more of about the 25th Amendment. I think a lot of people were under the impression that that would be the fastest way to remove President Trump from office, but it's not necessarily fast or simple, is it?
No, it's not. The steps that people are talking about are laid out in Article 4 of the 25th Amendment, and the process is a pretty complicated one that involves two branches of government and multiple individuals. It would begin with the vice president and probably a majority of the cabinet reporting to the president pro tem of the Senate and to Speaker Pelosi that they don't think President Trump is capable of carrying out his duties. And then President Trump would have a number of days to respond. Between those times, Vice President Pence would assume the powers of the presidency, but Trump would still actually be president. He just wouldn't be able to use, for example, the commander-in-chief powers. If President Trump then told the Speaker that he was capable of carrying out his job, then he would resume the powers, and then it would be up to the Vice President and a majority of the Cabinet to respond to that and send that information to Congress, and then Congress could act. Whereas with impeachment, Speaker Pelosi could decide to waive the usual hearings that we assume go along with impeachment and have impeachment before members to vote on within a week.
Susan Page, what could President Trump do in the remaining days that would actually be done by those who work for him? What are the worries?
Well, there are a couple worries. One is the likelihood that he's going to be issuing more pardons, possibly even a pardon of himself. Not entirely historically clear if a president can pardon himself preemptively, but we know that the president has talked to aides about his desire to do that. His friends, family members, allies of his, we expect to see more pardons. That is a presidential power established in the Constitution. The other is his power as commander-in-chief. You know, we have tensions all around the world in places with it, with Iran, with China. And so the president is the commander-in-chief, would have the power to order troops into battle. We know that when we saw a couple days ago all the living former secretaries of defense issue a statement of concern, there was some speculation that they are concerned about what might happen with the commander-in-chief powers in these last 12 days or so that the president has in the White House.
Ron, can Trump be impeached after he leaves office, after January 20th? Some people have floated this with the idea that that would make him not be able to run again.
At this point, we're really in uncertain ground. The impeachment uses a legal language, but it's a political process. And essentially what would have to happen is an argument would have to be made that would then, I'm sure, be tried out in the courts. And until then, we can't say for sure. The same is true of this idea of the president being able to pardon himself. I've read arguments on both sides of whether or not the courts would allow that to stand. And we'd have to wait and see how the process sorts itself out. My guess would be if impeachment is going to happen, that it's going to happen quickly.
And Susan Page, I want to turn to you about that. You mentioned before Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. I know that you have just completed a book about her, so you know intimately how she thinks. What is going on in her mind right now, and what tools, how quickly can she do this?
She can do this quite quickly. There are two resolutions being devised and gathering supporters in the House now that call for the president's impeachment. Remember that his impeachment by the House does not remove him from office. And in a way, that makes it an easier decision for Nancy Pelosi to go ahead and do this. It is a statement of rebuke. And so, as we learned last time, and her reasoning last time, when I interviewed her several times about the impeachment process when the president was impeached just a year ago, her argument was, the House would act to impeach, and that would stain the president's legacy. And it doesn't matter to the House if the Senate will go ahead and actually remove him from office. That was her argument last time. And I suspect, although I haven't talked to her in the past 24 hours, that she is feeling that even more so. One other thing I might mention. Last time, you know, she held off on impeachment for a long time while many House Democrats wanted to move ahead and impeach President Trump. And one of her considerations was that politically it was not a smart thing to do, that we knew from the impeachment of President Clinton that rebounded against the Republicans who impeached him. That is no longer an issue now. The 2020 election is over and President Trump has lost.
On the line with us now, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree. Representative Pingree, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Happy to join you. Thank you.
Tell us about Wednesday. Where were you? Where was your staff?
Well, I hadn't planned to have any staff in the office. We all were very clear that it was going to be, a high security day and that we had to be prepared for everything. You know, we forget that this is in the context of COVID. So unlike a normal day in a joint convention, the entire Congress would have been on the floor, but we were only allowed to come in relatively small groups or to observe from the balcony. So I was literally headed in when they pretty much at that moment found a pipe bomb in front of the Republican headquarters. doors. They shut down the entrance. They wouldn't allow us into the building. So I was fortunate enough, in a sense, to be able to back up, go to a safe location. I didn't go into the building or to my office building until later in the day, and then just spent a long day actually in a colleague's office, so we weren't alone in our offices way down at the end of the corridor. But, you know, from talking to my colleagues who were stuck on the floor or up in the gallery, it was a horrific moment in time. And as we're seeing it all unfold, how close the rioters got to the chamber, how unprepared the security was for this, it's just unfolding. But it was a horrific day. And we just have a lot to unpack here. And, of course, as you've been already discussing, we're having a caucus call right at noon, and we're talking about, you know, what next steps do we do here, particularly if the vice president won't take the next step and use Article 25. Will the Congress come back in to impeach? What will we do next?
So at noon, a caucus called. So does that mean that a decision has not been made? Do you know if a decision has been made?
A decision really involves the Democratic caucus. So, many of us have already weighed in with the speaker. We've already got two resolutions that have been proposed for a renewed call for impeachment. We've got letters saying to the speaker, even though we all basically left Washington, that we should all come right back in and deal with this. I think particularly people feel like, the president shouldn't be allowed to get away with inciting this kind of riot, and people need to understand just the depths of damage this has done to our democracy, how people view us around the world, the importance of moving forward. So we will have a very rigorous discussion of this at noon, and my guess is that we'll move forward and Congress will be coming back in to move forward on this.
And when you say coming back in, do you think tomorrow?
I don't know. That's a very good question. You know, it takes us a little while. Once we leave Washington, particularly right now during COVID, there aren't as many flights available and it takes us longer to travel. But it could be as early as this weekend. I literally don't know. And we do have to come to an agreement that that's what we're going to do. But from all my conversations, with leadership and with my colleagues, I feel that's very likely to have happened, even though it's a very short time frame. You know, we understand the limitations here, but I think we also just feel like there has to be a response.
Congresswoman Pingree, I want to ask you a couple other questions. With the election of two Democrats in the Georgia Senate races, the White House and both houses of Congress will now be controlled by your party. Given that, what are your priorities? What do you believe Congress can do right away?
Well, right away, without a doubt, President-elect Biden will tackle the pandemic. This has just been, as we all know, a horrific response from the Trump administration. And as quickly as possible, better mechanisms for getting the vaccines out, use of the Defense Production Authority to make sure we have adequate supplies, vaccines, testing. You know, we have to move very quickly to do all the things that other countries have been doing and that we know should have been done. Second will be an aid package. There was a lot negotiated out of the last aid package. It took us months and months to come to an agreement between the craziness of the White House and the difficulties in dealing with the Senate. But we will do that. We will hopefully provide aid to state and local governments who are really challenged by revenue shortfalls and also small businesses, unemployment. We just have to shore up this economy and get ourselves through the next few months. Then I believe that, President Biden will have a very big agenda, and I'm particularly interested in, because of the way my committee assignments and the things I work on, is the idea that he's going to tackle climate change as quickly as possible. I mean, that is our next disaster looming, and we have not been able to give it the attention it needs. And it's a long list, education, economic inequality, racial justice. I mean, I think he will move forward on all fronts and, frankly, have a really strong and experienced cabinet to do it.
Let me ask you about a couple other specific issues. What about statehood for Washington, D.C.?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already had strong support for that in the House. And, one of the things we've learned of the multitude of things that went on, President Trump refused to call up the National Guard. We were inadequately protected with a Capitol security, and we're going to come to the bottom of that. The Appropriations Committee has already called for an investigation, and people have resigned. But the Guard should have been there from the very beginning. There should have been tons of reinforcements and no ability for somebody to breach the Capitol. Why that didn't happen, I don't know. But the very fact that that D.C. is not a state, so they cannot call up the National Guard the way the governor of Maine could or any other state. We literally had leadership on the phone calling the governors of other states from a protected room, just begging them to stand in the guard. So, A, I believe in statehood for a very long time. It's totally taxation without representation. That would be great. And if we have, you know, both the House and the Senate, I think we could move forward on that.
Do you think there will be quick action on fixing some of the problems with the ACA and perhaps instituting a Medicare option?
I think there will be very quick actions on the ACA. I think there will be, a tremendous amount of research and committee work done to look at Medicare. And most likely, it would start with a public option. That was the one thing that was dropped in the first passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was something I strongly supported so that we had either a way to buy into Medicare or a public option available for more choice and more competition. But some of the problems we already know we have to fix. We won't have this fight anymore about should it be repealed. We will say, yeah, let's go ahead. We're going to have this as our plan, but we got to make it functioning and working, particularly right now when adequate health care is such a huge issue for many people who are either out of work and have lost their benefits, and we're going through a global pandemic and don't know how long many of the symptoms of this will persist with many people who have contracted the disease.
I note that you're an advocate of raising the cap of Social Security. Do you believe that will happen in the short term?
Well, I mean, you're starting to crunch in on, like, you know, how many hours in the day are there? But I will say, I was lucky enough to be there the first 2 years of President Obama. And one thing I learned was that, you know, those 2 years, in retrospect, were the only 2 years that he had in the majority with the House and the Senate. And we know with the volatility of politics, it could be the same. So the importance of working on all fronts, on all things that have been, you know, put off for too long or become partisan fights for too long, just fix them and move on. Because particularly you might have only 2 years. I will say during that first Obama term, 2009, 2010, we worked long days, long hours, often voting long into the night. So I would expect, within the limitations of the pandemic, which of course really, really challenge us, but we'll just try to put in as many hours as we can to work on all these fronts. And I'm sure many more that are on the Biden list that we won't even get to.
Well, before I let you go, I have to ask, with changes on the House Appropriations Committee, you will move up in seniority and could potentially be chairwoman of the Interior Subcommittee. What would that mean for Maine?
Oh, it's just really exciting. I'm so pleased. We're never quite sure about that till about mid-January, but I am next in line. And the Interior Appropriations Committee has oversight of the EPA, the Department of Interior, all of our public lands, national parks, everything to do with the arts and culture, and in all those areas, plus many more, tribal relations. There's a lot of impact in Maine. So just quickly, obviously the EPA is critically important. It's been gutted under this administration. We need to be out there in full force dealing with climate change, but also states get a tremendous amount of support from the federal government to run our own departments of environment and also to do, you know, everything from climate change preparedness to just cleaning up, brownfields and waste sites, many of which, once they're cleaned up, can become, you know, productive sites for communities, old mills that get developed and all those things. So that's really important. The Department of Interior, has been gutted, and everyone who ever worked there on climate change, including Joel Clement, who was a Mainer who was in a prominent job, hopefully we'll get those people back and we'll really start taking up a serious assessment around climate change and what we need to do next. The national parks, the maintenance budget has been, you know, non-existent for years. Places like Acadia do not have the support that they need, and I hope we can turn that around. Bureau of Indian Affairs, Native communities have been disproportionately affected by COVID and have really inadequate support for health care, education. We do not meet our treaty obligations with tribes across the country, so I'm very enthusiastic about being able to work with that, and particularly if Deb Haaland, who is the nominee from President-elect Biden, who is a Native American herself, if she is able to become the head of Interior, it'll be a groundbreaking time, and it will be just wonderful to work with her to fix and right many of those wrongs.
Well, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, thank you so much for calling in. Representative Pingree represents Maine's 1st Congressional District. We're talking about events in the nation's capital and the future. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. Bangor.com/spreadkindness.
We are only 1 week into the new year, and already armed insurrectionists have stormed the U.S. Capitol, attempting, it seems, to overturn the results of November's presidential election. We'll break down what happened and what might happen next with a team of NPR political reporters. That's next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Join us for this new program Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. here on Maine Public Radio.
What do a vaccine scientist, the Federal Reserve, and mixed martial arts have in common? They're all part of the Planet Money extravaganza we call The Rest of the Story. And on How I Built This, we meet a self-described anxious entrepreneur who says being self-aware has made her a better leader.
People respond to people who understand themselves and who aren't fake.
That's on the next Planet Money and How I Built This from NPR.
Planet Money and How I Built This, Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. and a repeat broadcast Wednesday evening at 10 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, analysis of the national news, the events in Washington, and what to expect next. Our guests are Susan Page, USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief, and author of the new book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power, and Ron Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. You can share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Andrew Rudalevich, who is chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, as well as professor of government. He is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Andrew, thank you for giving us a call and welcome back.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
After the events of Wednesday, a lot of people are asking, what are the limits of presidential power, especially in these remaining days of the Trump presidency? What can and cannot the president do?
Well, some of this was touched on earlier by Susan Page, talking about, for example, some of the unilateral powers vested in the president, the pardon power perhaps being the most dramatic of those. That's a power that's not really checkable by the other branches. From the president's point of view, the bad news, I guess, is that the powers of the presidency are largely delegated by Congress. The good news, depending on your point of view at the moment, is that Congress has delegated a lot of power over time, and some of that is in the military sphere, as we heard before. So in terms of the broader actions a president might take in a two-week period, you know, a lot of that would revolve around the pardon power, around the commander-in-chief power, but there are also some administrative powers we might look at with regards to the shape of the government and what is left in place for the new administration.
Can Congress in any way constrain the president?
Sure. Congress can pass laws requiring, for example, the president act in a certain way. They can pass budget provisions, and they did that a little bit in the most recent fiscal 2021 package that they passed.
I guess I mean in the next few days, between now and January 20th.
Well, in theory, sure. I mean, Congress can pass legislation very quickly, for example, preventing the president from spending money. That's its largest power, the power of the purse. Preventing the president from spending money on, for example, implementation of an executive order that he issued right before the election, which could have the potential of really undermining the civil service, the continuity of government, creating a new schedule of political appointees that can be removed. That would be something Congress could do. Now, again, is it practically likely that Congress will reconvene and pass that kind of legislation quickly? It's really not, which gives the executive branch a little bit of an advantage there.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Andrew Rudilevich, professor of government at Bowdoin College, author of the upcoming book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. We look forward to having you back on to Maine Calling. We're going to go to some of our callers now, starting with Nathan in Brunswick. Hi, Nathan. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm calling in to question the effects of reporting by the right media. The effect that Fox News has, I mean, I make it a point to watch Fox News every Sunday. I mean, Chris Wallace is one of the most respected journalists I've ever watched, I think. I think he does a pretty good job, but anybody behind him, it seems like they are just as off the wall as a lot of these people that have come out of the woodwork over this short period of time. And it concerns me. And I don't understand why there is no check, like the BBC is required by law to only report the truth. And, or at least they're not allowed to put their opinion on the air. And I think that's something that we all need to look at, is the fact that the truth has been been confused with opinion. And I think that's one of the most powerful messages we can take away from what's happened. It's very concerning.
And yeah, Nathan, thank you so much for your call. Yeah, I'm going to turn to Susan Page, because Susan, you mentioned how long you've been a reporter in Washington, but it's also how long you've been a reporter, and you've seen how the entire the world of journalism we operate in has changed.
Yes, of course, we've got the First Amendment that protects the press, and thank goodness for that. But Nathan's certainly right that we've seen in the past couple decades the rise of more opinionated news outlets that have enormous power. And people on the right might point to MSNBC as a news outlet that has a point of view, generally a Democratic one. Certainly Fox News has been an important part of the rise of the Republican Party and conservative support for Donald Trump. You know, when you look at Fox News or any place else, I think you need to not maybe paint with a totally broad brush, because Nathan mentioned Chris Wallace. I agree. I have a lot of respect for Chris. Brett Baier is another journalist at Fox News. I think it plays it right down the middle, promotes truth, not falsehood. But you also have opinion shows there that have sometimes failed to act as a check on President Trump and have sometimes amplified the falsehoods that President Trump has promoted, including just most recently the idea that he didn't legitimately lose this election. We just saw this week in the halls of Congress how damaging promoting that lie can be.
Ron Schmidt, thoughts about the rise of the right-wing media?
Yeah, I remember during the George W. Bush administration reading about how Vice President Cheney requested that TVs and hotel rooms he stayed at all be set to Fox News and that the TV be left on so that would be playing when he walked in. And for me, that's always been a really good example of the kind of bubble that particular news outlets can form around people in public life. And I think that's a problem. You know, in talking to students, I tell them about how a lot of people think that the last episode of the TV sitcom MASH will probably wind up having the biggest audience in American TV watching history, just because that was the last moment before broadcast television really splintered into all these different little niches that we have now. And particularly for people in public life, speaking only to your niche and listening only to your niche makes it harder to govern and makes it harder to have a sense of where the people of your nation are. It makes it more difficult to talk comprehensively with people who don't share your opinions. And it's now been years, and I think we can see the pernicious effects of that. And of course, Susan's exactly right. This week gave us a very disturbing example of where eventually that kind of thing can lead.
Nathan, thank you for your call. We'll move up to North Yarmouth and John. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I just want to urge rapid action on the removal of Mr. Trump, because there are press reports saying that he's preparing to self-pardon and pardon others who have contributed to this insurrection at the Capitol on January 19th. So to be effective, the removal has to happen quickly. And thank you.
Sure. As Susan Page, lots of questions coming in via email about the President Trump's ability to pardon himself, and now John's question about the ability to pardon those who mobbed the Capitol on Wednesday.
You know, that is, I had not even, John, I had not even heard that raised as a possibility. That would certainly be extraordinary if the president issued, I don't know, maybe Ron has a better sense of this. I'm not sure you can pardon somebody you don't name, so I'm not sure you can say, I pardon everybody who participated in this riot. But that is certainly an alarming prospect. There is some thought, you know, I think for the president's removal from office is going to be problematic in the next week and a half. But I think the fact that the House might move ahead to impeach him, that there are these enormous calls for his removal via the 25th Amendment, I think that in itself may act as something of a constraint on him. And one reason I say that is because of this video that he released last night, which finally conceded the election, committed himself to a peaceful transfer of power. I think that may be a reflection that he hears the firestorm that is now raging against him, and he wants to not make it worse.
Ron, thoughts?
I think one of the things that has made President Trump particularly dangerous is his attack on basic democratic norms and the processes by which our politics function. A big part of what makes democracies work is law and institutions. But another big part is just the insubstantial belief in the minds of people that the process as a whole, which is often very disappointing, is legitimate. I think that an impeachment and a quick impeachment of President Trump will shore up the idea that you can't, say, for example, sack the Capitol, that you can't use violence, that you can't continually deny the facts of the outcome of an election without facing some sort of consequence, will shore up in the minds of people that there is actually a legitimate political and legal system in play here.
Mm. John, thank you for your question. Going to go here to, let's see, an email from Constantino. If Trump isn't prosecuted for his crimes, this will only embolden populist swamp creatures like Hawley and Cruz. Authoritarian wannabe politicians are not going away until people vote them out. And from Deborah, a tweet, no one is going to enact the 25th. This is all theater, as it has been for years. It would be nice to impeach again, but until these traitors are in jail, I will reserve my hope. And from Pamela, an email, what's the chance that Trump Sr. and Jr. will face charges after January 20th? Also, how about Giuliani? Didn't they invite this coup? For that question, I'll turn to you, Susan. Is there talk about charges? I mean, I know there's talk, but what are the chances of them?
Well, the question about whether they could face charges. You know, there are multiple investigations going on, some at the federal level, some at the state level, including by New York State, into the president and his business operations, which, of course, include members of his family. And, of course, the president, there's a lot of speculation that the president will offer some kind of pardon of his children. He can't do that when it comes to the state charges. So that if these investigations that are ongoing in New York State lead to charges, a federal pardon doesn't help you. But just to go back to the point that the first email you read goes to, I think one of the big concerns we have in terms of our democracy is whether norms have been shattered in a way that other politicians are going to follow, so that another politician in the future won't feel compelled to acknowledge the results of an election, to concede the election, to allow their successor to take over in a peaceful way. I mean, that is President Trump, he's going to be out of office one way or another in 12 days, but will he leave a legacy that emboldens others to follow some of the paths he's taken in the past few weeks and in the past 4 years? And that's a question I don't think we know the answer to yet.
Mm. Well, we are talking about national politics right now, everything that's unfolded in Washington this week and the future. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. What an incredible week it has been. Incited by President Trump, a mob stormed the Capitol in what's being called an insurrection.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden is certified as the next president, and Democrats win control of the Senate with two special election victories in Georgia.
We'll wrap up the week's biggest news. That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us this morning, Here and Now, upcoming at the top of the hour at 12 noon today on Maine Public Radio.
We know vaccine distribution is hard. It is especially hard in rural America.
The problem we're running into is logistics here locally is we're only getting, our county is only getting 100 doses a week.
I'm Kai Risdahl, an Ohio doctor, on how his practice and his community have been coping with this pandemic. That's next time on Marketplace.
And you can hear Marketplace this evening at 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, reaction to this week's events in Washington, D.C., from the insurrection to the new makeup of the Senate to the certification of the Electoral College vote. My guests, Susan Page, USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief, and USM Political Science Professor Ron Schmidt. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Ron, something we haven't talked about so far is what the new makeup of the Senate means for Maine's U.S. Senator Susan Collins. It was thought that she would have a lot of power if the Senate had a narrow Republican majority, but that will not be the case. What do you see as her role now?
It really depends on how what kind of moves we see coming from the Senate leadership and what the mood of the Senate is as they begin to get underway. A lead this close by the Democratic Party, a tie basically with the vice president able to break ties, could empower Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, and it could empower Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski of Alaska, members of the Senate who've shown that they are capable of pulling together bipartisan coalitions. I think from his language, President-elect Biden would like to see that take place. On the other hand, if the Democrats, keeping in mind, you know, Susan's point about how this could be the only two solid years they get of majorities, the Democrats could decide to move quickly to shore up what needs to be done. And in that case, Senator Collins could wind up being a lot less important.
Susan Page, your thoughts on the role and the power of Senator Susan Collins. She will not be chair of appropriations now, will she?
She won't. Her party won't be in power, but she's going to have, I think, a position with a lot of leverage. Because as Ron said, a 50-50 Senate, you just need to lose one Democrat to be in trouble if you're on the Democratic side. So I think the power of the moderates on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, is going to be enhanced with that kind of even divide. And it also fits, as Ron was saying, with the general approach that Joe Biden has taken. He has really made a point, even back in those primary debates when he was being pushed by progressives to be more partisan, to make the point that he really thinks it's a time to try to step back from the fierce partisanship that has polarized Congress for so long. Some people say good luck in doing that, but he says he intends to do that. One other point, the next 2 years are going to be breathtaking for Democrats. Democrats assume that they will likely lose control of the House in 2 years. That's been the history of the first midterm in modern times for a president. That happened to Bill Clinton. It happened to Barack Obama. They are not counting on having more than the next 2 years to have unified control of Congress. So everything they can get done, they are going to try to get done.
We'll go to Jessica calling from South Berwick. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I recently was in Washington. I go there often. And I was actually at the Capitol and the White House. And I was just so impressed by the security. I mean, there were machine guns, there were checkpoints. It was intense. It was more than I had ever seen. So my question is, are they just going to brush this under the rug, or is someone going to investigate how these people were able to get into the Capitol building? I mean, with the level of security that's there with biometrics and key cards, and how in the world were these people able to get in there?
Jessica, I think you are asking a question millions of people are asking. Susan Page, how on earth did this happen?
Yeah. Now, of course, the security at the White House has always been pretty tight. But the security at the Congress actually has been kind of proud of the fact that it's the people's house, that they let citizens come in to see what's going on, to talk to their representatives. That's been a point of pride for Congress. But the scenes that we saw on Wednesday were shocking. The lack of security, the failure to be prepared for a rally that they knew was coming, already heads have rolled. Already people have resigned. The head of the Capitol Police has resigned. There's going to be more resignations, I think, in the leadership that was in charge of providing security at the Capitol, because we saw these photographs of members of Congress hiding under desks to try to protect themselves from the sound of gunfire in the rotunda. This is something we've not seen since 1814, and we do not want to see it again.
Jessica, thank you for your question, reflecting the concerns of so many Americans. I'm going to Marilyn, calling from Scarborough. Hi, Marilyn, go ahead.
From the sound of gunfire in the rotunda?
Marilyn, if you could turn off your radio and go ahead. Thank you.
And we do not want to see it again.
Okay, so I'm going to move on here. I'm going to go to Kathleen, calling from Farmington. Hi, Kathleen. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. My concern is about the inauguration. I want to see it, and I want to see it legitimate, but where there'd be no possibility of violence. Is it possible for it to be virtual but still be legitimate? Thank you.
Susan, is there any chance of a virtual inauguration?
Well, we've seen inaugurations before that have taken place not in the traditional stand. I remember President Reagan's second inauguration when it was freezing cold and they moved it into the White House itself. So an inauguration doesn't have to be in a particular place or even in a public place. But the plan now is to go ahead with an inauguration on the front of the Capitol for all of Americans to see, socially distanced, and it won't look like the inaugurations we've seen in the past. President Trump said this morning that he will not attend the inauguration. That was a question that a lot of people had. He had not answered before. There was a report this morning that Vice President Pence will attend the inauguration, although his office hasn't officially confirmed that. So I think we will see an inauguration that Americans can watch on TV, although they're not encouraging people to come onto the mall and have the traditional masses of crowds there, not just for security reasons, but also for health reasons because of COVID. We're not going to see the traditional inaugural parade, but there will be, I think, an effort to have, in a virtual sense, some kind of celebration that marks this big occasion. It just won't be like what we're used to.
All right. We'll go to Sacco and Ethan. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I wanted to go back to your guy from Nathan that called and say, yeah, I agree a little bit, but also we're at a point where propaganda is legal in this country, and I believe propaganda and censorship is a really big issue, and by the way, Obama signed it into law, H.R. 4310 in 2012, I think it was. But so when you, like George Washington said, when you lose the First Amendment, you're going to be marched like slaves to the slaughter. So, and your caller who said the security at the Capitol is a huge concern. How did these people get in? And when you have people like Antifa and things throwing bricks in the summertime and no politicians calling it out, now you have all of a sudden this attack or this insurgence is being called. And do not go down the road, please, of saying it's a racial issue. But one thing I feel like now in this divided country, I feel so much like I personally am a white, white, what do you call it, porcupine, because I'm rare. I don't have a home on the right, and I don't have a home on the left, because if you do, you're forced to take sides, And it's very sad. And the white porcupine is rare, and it's also vulnerable because if it speaks out, it can be attacked and taken down. And I think in this country today, I feel so I'm sorry. It's been a hard week, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think we're going down the road of tyranny, and you've got to look at the deep state in this country, which I feel really runs the country.
Sure.
And where Donald.
So, Jennifer, Ethan, you've already used a couple terms that are used by one side here, Antifa and deep state. And Susan Page, I want you to talk about that. Talk about this language. Talk about what Ethan's talking about. What is it that makes people doubt what they're seeing right before them on live television?
Yeah, there's nothing more corrosive to our democracy than the distribution of disinformation and the refusal to kind of agree on what the truth is. I don't mean the political truth. I don't mean the right way to approach health care. I'm talking about just an agreement on who won an election. And, you know, you hear in Ethan's voice how passionately he feels about this and how estranged he feels from our politics, but you also hear him talking about some of the ways in which some Americans have gone down a path that leads them to question all institutions with all the destruction that's followed. And just it affects everything. It affects the willingness of Americans to take the vaccine for COVID because they do not believe the assurances of the FDA that it has been fully tested and is safe to take. So it's not just a political question. It's one that goes to every corner of our society, and it's just of such enormous alarm and concern. And maybe Ron can put this in some kind of historical perspective. Maybe we've gone through times like this before, but in the time I've been covering politics in America, this is just worse than ever.
Ron.
One thing that happened this week that kind of got lost in the shuffle of enormous events was that the National Association of Manufacturers called out for the use of the 25th Amendment. The National Association of Manufacturers is the biggest professional and lobbying organization for major industrial enterprises in the U.S., like ExxonMobil, for example, and Dow Chemical, and Caterpillar are members. It gives money to both parties, but it's more part of the GOP's sort of network of alliances than the Democrats. And one of the things that sort of reminded us of is that at a time when we tend to think of political parties like their ideological movements with their own truths, alternate news and so on, the political parties are actually big, big coalitions of interest groups that are supposed to be cooperating on candidates and slates of policy ideas to affect changes that they feel that the nation needs. What happened with the collapse of security at the Capitol, for example? That is a crisis of a governmental institution that failed to horrible effect. And we don't need, I think, to worry about whether or not one party or the other gives us a spiritual home. We need to figure out what went wrong and how to pull together the numbers that we need in government to fix it. We need to make sure that the inauguration is safe. The fact that the Secret Service is worried about whether there will be enough protections for the president is incredibly worrisome, and we need a practical fix. And I think that is what parties can do if we stop thinking of them as repositories of tribal truths.
And Ethan, so you know, on Monday, Maine Calling's discussion is about just this. We're going to be talking about I was going to say the political divide, but really the divide that is seems so entrenched in our country and how we might be moving forward from here. So I appreciate your call. We're going to move to Mary in Bremen. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes. The reason I'm calling is this is a very interesting program. But I want to know, what can we, the people, do? My husband and I were so upset Wednesday night, as many Americans were. We decided to call our representatives on Thursday. We called Collins' office, we called King's office, and Pingree's office. And we said we wanted, when we talked to Susan Collins, the representative, we talked about the fact that we wanted to know if she would take herself and other moderate Republicans and even the Republicans who were retired and go to Vice President Pence and ask him to invoke the 25th Amendment. So after doing that, there was a meeting of, and I am a registered Democrat, as my husband is, there was a Zoom meeting of our Democratic committee here in Lincoln County, and we came to the decision that all the people on the meeting, 20-some people, would be calling our representatives, and we would be getting, and I've been doing that this morning, calling people to ask them to call, and talking about 25th Amendment number one, and if not, will you support having the impeachment take place?
Sure,
so,
Mary. Yeah.
I want to know, is there anything else we, the people, can do right now?
Thank you for your call. Ron?
Thank you so much, Mary, for your question and for what you've been doing. Democracy is practices. It's a way of life, and you're engaging in it. And contacting your representatives and your senators is a huge part of that process. You know, I'm proud as a Mainer that Representative Pingree is a co-sponsor of both of the bills of impeachment working their way through the House right now. And the fact that she's hearing from constituents is a big part of why she feels the impulse to do that. And that kind of on-the-ground meeting and discussion among citizens is also part of how we answer the anxieties of other people about the so-called deep state or this sense of disconnection.
Susan Page, we have about 30 to 40 seconds left.
Well, I'll just bring the latest news to your audience. Nancy Pelosi just announced that she's called the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss control of the nuclear codes. That's how concerned she is about this last week and a half of President Trump's term. So these are times like we've never seen before.
Oh, my gosh. Breathtaking. Mary, thank you for your call. And thank you so much to our guests today. Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today in Washington and author of the forthcoming book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Hope to have you back on the program, Susan, when your book is released.
Thank you, Ron Schmidt. I'd love to be back.
Yeah, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. His most recent book is Reading Politics with Machiavelli. Today's sound engineer was George Thomas. You can visit mainecalling.org to listen to this program again or find previous programs. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.